Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out. And when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish-resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com. We're recording.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another Baseball America podcast. I'm Kyle Glazer alongside Hudson Belinsky and Carlos Collazo. Thank you for tuning in to today's BA podcast. Our podcast is sponsored by Baseballism. Baseballism is the official off-the-field brand of baseball, offering apparel for men, women, and kids. Looking for that perfect Father's Day gift or maybe something special for that recent graduate? Visit Baseballism.com and enter the code BA2017 to receive free shipping on your next order. Guys, the draft is coming up in less than a week. Obviously, the BA 500 dropped yesterday. We've got scouting reports on all 500 players now up on our website, BA.com. Look, we all know about Hunter Green. We all know about Brendan McKay. We all know about J.B. Bukauskas and Royce Lewis. We know about the big dogs. We've talked about the big dogs. But every year, there's guys who are drafted in the 8th, 9th, 10th, 20th rounds who 4 or 5 years later, they're in the big leagues. So I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the guys that we all think have a chance to maybe be a surprise guy, a guy that, for whatever reason, is not considered a prime draft prospect right now. But as you move forward in his career, you really want to keep an eye on him. Carlos, I want to start with you. You got a good look at guys at the National High School Invitational. I know a couple guys really stood out to you there. Who's your personal late-round cheese ball, if you will?
Yeah, well, I guess the first guy I have to start out with is Carlos Morales. I chose him just because he has my first name. No, he's a pitcher, spells it with a K, which is nice for a pitcher. He's a lanky lefty out of South Hills in West Covina, California. And I think I saw his first game in a National High School Invitational, like you said. And during that game, he was effectively wild the whole time, pretty much, is what I saw. But he's got really good plane on his fastball. I think the one big knock on him right now is that his curveball is not very consistent. When I saw it, he struggled at times getting on top of that pitch regularly, but he did flash it a couple times, and when he gets on top of it, it has a really sharp bite. I think he only allowed 2 hits during that entire outing, complete game for him, and he also flashed some talent on the offensive side, but I think teams are definitely looking at him on the mound. He's a really interesting pitcher. He's got to clean up some of these off-speed pitches, but no, he was a good look for me, one of the more interesting guys I saw right away in that tournament.
For those of you who don't know, Carlos and Hudson really took the lead on our draft stuff this year, but I helped out in Southern California, just being where I'm from. If you listen to our podcast, you know I drop a SoCal homeboy reference every chance I get, so here's this one. But talking to scouts about Morales, it was interesting what you mentioned, how he is this big, lanky left-hander that has a lot of things people like, but that athleticism he showed on the other side of the ball, a couple people actually like him as an outfielder.
Yeah.
I mean, when you see a guy who's that talented, that can impact the ball on both sides as a prep, It's really promising. You mentioned the curveball. The velocity on it was also down a little bit. You want to see more there. There's some mechanical flaws teams and scouts have talked about. But when you talk about, like I said, athletic, left-handed, good body, plays at a really good program, has had success at a really good program, he's definitely a guy that's interesting.
And that's the thing. When you think about these guys from a value perspective and who are the big leaguers that are going to be later in the draft, you know, on your list, you should always have left-handers, especially athletic ones. If they throw strikes, if they have got velocity, if they can spin the ball at all, they should be on your list. And Carlos Morales, maybe not the most consistent guy right now on the mound, but you're talking about a potential impactful lefty on the mound, a guy who's got a loose arm, who's got pretty efficient arm action, pretty short arm stroke. You know, looks like he has the athleticism to eventually develop into a strike thrower. There's some spin on that breaking ball. He doesn't quite get to it as often as you'd like, but definitely an exciting one. And I think that if you look up and down our list, you can find a lot of lefties on there for similar reasons.
Mm-hmm. Hudson, moving over to you now, who's one of your guys that you see and you think has a good chance to be a value pick in later rounds that you could see rise above maybe his draft status?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I'm sticking with the lefty theme on the BA 500. You can check out the report on Hugh Fisher, who's number 327. He's a lefty out of Memphis area, committed to Vanderbilt. This is what they look like when they're in high school. He's like 6'5", 200-ish pounds, maybe a little bit less than that. Really, really good-looking athlete, body. Same kind of deal. You're looking for somebody who can be a little bit more consistent with the breaking ball. But in terms of his physical projection, right now he's pitching with an average-type fastball. You can really dream on this guy pitching with a plus fastball. He's going to go to Vanderbilt. You know, Vanderbilt's track record, obviously, developing players like that. We see it with Kyle Wright this year, who's got a chance to be the first overall pick in the draft. Had interest in high school, didn't get a ton of interest, goes to campus, and develops 3 years later. Now he's a potential first overall pick. So I think Hugh Fisher, not saying he's necessarily going to be that, but he's got that kind of upside, and you can dream on a guy who's got those kinds of tools.
Absolutely. You know, I'm going to go away a little bit from, we talk about what's the traditional demographic we see in. You mentioned left-handers. Another demographic sometimes you see is crazy good defenders. Think about like Kevin Pillar, Kevin Kiermaier, 19th round, 32nd round, able to go and just to have that center field defense carry them. I'm even going to go away from that a little bit. And there's a guy out at Orange Coast College, a very good JC program in Southern California I like a lot, named Eric Wagaman. Big, strong, physical, so right-handed hitting college first baseman. It's not the greatest demographic in the world. There's no question about it. But with him, I see a guy who's played Aliso Niguel High School, was part of a team that made it to a championship game with Blake Sable and Kyle Molnar. He's played with the big dogs at every level. He's been a stud with the big dogs at every level throughout Southern California. And you look what he did this year at the California JC level, among the state leaders in home runs, slugging percentage. But he's not just this big hulking slugger who can't move. He's well built. He's strong all across his body. Even though he's not going to flash you the greatest run times as an athlete, the swing is plenty quick and athletic in the box. I think there's a lot there. And you see a guy who has maybe that carrying tool. And for me, Eric Wagaman's power should play. We're going to find out, because California Junior College Baseball this year, the pitching was not as good as it has been some other years, so he wasn't totally challenged. But talking to scouts who have seen him, they think he has all the components to be successful against those 92s, 93s, 94s. And sometimes when you have that carrying tool and its power, someone will find a spot for you.
Absolutely, and you think about it, Wagaman, number 386 on the BA 500. When you're talking about that point in the draft, there aren't, you know, we're always looking for guys who have plus tools across the board and are going to be face of the franchise type guys. And then the lower we get, the fewer tools we can find. And so you have to take chances later in the draft. And a guy who's got some potential for a carrying tool like that offensively, you take a shot on that kind of guy. Because if it does translate, then boom, you've got something that's a lot more valuable than where you took that player.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, at that point, even if he's a platoon power hitting bench first baseman at 386 in the draft, that's what, 12th rounder, you'll take it. That's a pretty good ball player.
Yeah, and I think that's a, like, that brings us into another point, which there are players in this ranking, you will see, who are in the 200s, who are going to be drafted in the 38th round.
Right.
And these rankings don't consider signability. We don't care if, you know, some of these guys are going to go to college and be guys later for the draft. Our goal is to rank the players in terms of talent, and that's where this list goes. We're trying to rank players on talent from 1 to 500, and so you'll see high school guys that are going to go way later. You'll see college guys that are going to go way earlier than they're ranked, and, you know, so those are considerations when you're reading this list. Us saying, you know, Eric Wagaman's number 386 on the list doesn't mean we think he's going to go 386th overall. This isn't a top 500 mock.
That'd be impressive.
That's for sure. So as we talked about these sleepers, you guys brought up two high schoolers. I brought up a JC guy, but part of a project I'm doing right now actually looks at, you know, some of the, who are the big leaguers, and it really is overwhelming college guys, four-year college guys. You see that every position. Who are some of the guys at four-year universities you guys each see as maybe a late-round sleeper type?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a couple ways to look at that. Well, all those guys started off as high school guys.
This is true.
Is my defense of signing out of high school. If we want to talk about some guys who are later on, just scanning through our list, if we're looking at college guys. I think Zach Kirtley is a pretty interesting one from St. Mary's. And you,
big fan.
Yeah, I mean, Zach Kirtley coming in, or if you saw him on the right day in the Cape League last summer, you saw a player with a really quick bat and some feel to hit, and, you know, look like there's some power potential untapped in that bat still. Maybe not quite living up to that this spring, for at least for the scouts that I talked to about him. I don't know exactly what his performance was, but, you know, he's a guy who we have him number 318 on the BA 500 right now, who 6 months from now might be much better than a lot of the players who are ranked ahead of him. You don't know if he's going to turn it around, but if he can get some of that previous cachet back, you might have something, a nice value pick there.
And if I can jump in, I had the fortune of covering Kirtley in high school, my old job. You know, he's another guy. You talk about who are the guys who have been successful playing the big dogs at every level. He went to Redlands East Valley High School, home of Tyler Chatwood, Matt Andrees. I mean, division, you know, upper division, Southern California, creme de la creme program. He was the stud, the guy on his team. Goes to St. Mary's, a really good, underrated program, I think, in the western half of the United States. Puts up, you know, a really nice career starting from day one. So I think it's not just almost, you know, oh, well, here's his tools. It's the track record. Who are the guys who have been good every time they've had to face the best competition they can, and they've performed? And I do think he checks those boxes, for me at least.
One of the guys that I'm kind of thinking of right now is Marty Costas. He's a draft-eligible sophomore out of Maryland. About the guys who've got that track record and who have done nothing but perform. Costas is a guy who's performed really at every point in his career. His two seasons with Maryland, he's hit. He's done well with wood bats in the summer. He's got that track record to go for him. He's hit for power in the wood bat leagues as well. The one question with Costas is, where's
a Ripken league?
Yeah, he was. And where's he going to play at the next level? It's a big question for him. But you think about all the people who complain about the lack of college bats in the draft. He's a guy that, I mean, he's done nothing but hit. You have to wonder where he's going to play, and that's obviously his, maybe why he's 208 for us in this top 500.
Yeah, but I think it's a great point. And you know, you look at the guy. And I'm not saying this is a direct comparison, mm-hmm. Because you're talking about a different body type and mm-hmm. different swing and all that. But Willie Calhoun is a guy we talked about for the top 100, just the top 100 prospects, you know, guys in the minor leagues right now. In the off season, in the winter time, this is a guy we talked about in that context. And the discussion on Willie Calhoun is, well, where is he going to play? Where is he going to play? He can hit. And if you can hit, they're going to find a spot mm-hmm. for you. And Marty Costas, this guy's stout-bodied. He's, you know, everybody's afraid to love him because he's not this sexy defensive profile, and he's not a five-tool guy.
5'9", 200 pounds.
Well, guess what? When we're talking about the 200s, we're not going to find five-tool guys. We're going to find guys who can do a couple things well. And if you can hit and you have some power like he does, they're going to find a place for you to play. So I think that's a great call on Marty Costas.
Last summer he hit 319, 437, 560 with 7 home runs in the Cal Ripken Collegiate League. So.
Yeah, I mean, and he's also a draft-eligible sophomore, so he's going to have some leverage from a draft perspective. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly what he's looking for signability-wise, but again, this is a guy with maybe not the sexiest tools all around, but it's a pretty sexy bat.
Yep.
And the guy's got quick hands. He's got some power potential. You see this, like, he's probably 5'10". I don't have that in front of me, but just sizing him up,
yeah.
I would look at him and be like, he's probably 5'10", 220, something like that. Kind of a thicker, dumpier bodied guy.
Mm-hmm.
But it plays.
Yep.
And he's got quick hands. He shows power, raw power in batting practice. Checks the boxes offensively for sure.
You know, on my end, and again, I apologize. I have to keep going back to Southern California. That was
no,
just, that
no.
was just my draft area.
Yeah,
so that's what I
no,
know.
No, do it. So who do you like?
I mean,
in the
Ramsey Romano at Long
yeah.
Beach State. This is a guy who has been. First of all, he went started at Michigan. Was a two-sport guy. He was a backup quarterback under Jim Harbaugh on the football team, while also being a baseball player. Started Michigan as a freshman. Bounced back to Yavapai JC. Led Yavapai to a national championship. Shows up at Long Beach State and is their cleanup hitter, leading that helping get that team to the first Big West championship since 2008. They're now in the Super Regionals. This is a guy who's a really good athlete with really good baseball instincts, who's hit. He can play third base. He has the athleticism to play second. Again, just a guy who you talk about the intangibles, the guys who have all the little things that add up to a really good player, even if there's no 70-grade tool there. I think Ramsey Romano has a lot of those.
How about another guy in your area? This is a guy that we brought up early in the season because he got off to like a torrid start, is Tyler Atkinson at San Diego State. I think he's a guy that scouts would say that he doesn't have a carrying tool. He doesn't have anything that really jumps out at you, but he has absolutely mashed this season.
What's funny about Tyler Atkinson is you talk about unconventional profiles.
Mm-hmm.
Undersized, big power, no run, no defend, left field only.
Sounds a lot like Marty Costas.
You know, it's sort of
I think Marty Costas is a little bit better than Atkinson, but
you know, it's something where there's no question. This is a guy who, you know, he kind of got thrown off the radar because he took a pitch off his face and
mm-hmm.
missed all 2015. Comes back 2016, and, you know, it's fine, but it's not great. But this year, I don't know if he just got the confidence back in the box or whatever. Everyone talks about, you know, that short, quick swing
mm-hmm.
that he generates tremendous leverage through. I mean, talk to some scouts, there's one or two home runs they still talk about and chuckle like, man, he hit the heck out of that ball out of this 5'9", 5'10" frame. So, I mean, talk about short swings that play that'll catch up to velocity. I mean, maybe.
And that's a great point because that's another projection point for scouts who are looking at these players. We look at high contact rate guys, or guys who have short strokes who actually can generate some bat speed, can accelerate with the bat, and can generate future power. So you think about it, the example I always go to of a player, not someone who I evaluated personally, but just following the narrative of it, is Ben Zobrist. Ben Zobrist is a guy early in his major league career who's a short swing kind of guy who's going to work the gaps, and that's going to be his game. He realized he needs to hit for more power. He adds some more pre-pitch movement to his swing. He deepens his load, and all of a sudden, we've got a 30-homer guy. So we kind of break down these college guys, and we say, well, they don't hit for enough power. They don't look the part. We need guys who are going to hit 30 bombs in the big leagues. This guy's not going to do that. And then what happens is you take these short swing guys, you add some length. As long as they've got some rhythm, they've got some loose wrists, they've got feel to hit, and you trade a little bit of that contact for some power. And I think a good example of that last year in the draft was Nick Solak. Nick Solak was a guy who, with a metal bat, would hit these little squeakers over the fence, right, like barely clearing. And then now I'm texting with guys who are watching him. I guess he's in the Florida State League. They're like, who's this dude hitting opposite field bombs? Like, you know, he goes from being a high contact college hitter in a good conference to being a power hitter at the pro level. So when you talk about Atkinson that way, absolutely. Pavin Smith, an early draft guy who kind of fits that mold a little bit. Not a ton of strikeouts, but really good contact rate and some untapped power possibly in there.
When you look at projecting power in the future, I guess from a scouting standpoint, where do what do teams think about as far as your track record in a wood bat league? How important is that, at least as far as showing that in the past, versus guys who have hit for power with metal bats but haven't shown that in the wood bat?
I mean,
leagues. Does that make a big difference for scouts?
I think it makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
And when we have guys like Kyle Lewis, Mariners first-round pick last year, where on the Cape people are saying, hey, this guy, the ball comes off his bat like Vlad Guerrero with a wood bat.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost, at that point, you can only fall so far if you're doing that kind of thing with a wood bat in the Cape Cod League. or on the summer showcase circuit for a high school guy who's hitting with wood against good pitching. What you're really looking for is somebody who's shown power with wood and is going in the right direction, but you're looking for swing elements. Who's got fluidity in their swing? Who can hit the ball with authority to the opposite field? These are all the traits that you're looking for.
Recognize spin.
You know, there's those elements of just seeing the ball and having an approach. And, you know, if you're going to go, your approach is to go after the outside, the pitch middle away, and drive it to the opposite field with authority, and you can do that, and you can get your hands moving at full speed and hit an opposite field line drive, and that's your job in college baseball, and you get it done. To me, that's an indicator of future power. I see J.J. Matijevic, who I wrote about last week at Arizona, as a guy like this, who's been described as like an inside-out hitter, who's loose, head-over-power type guy. Well, right now, what's his job? His job is to get on base, to do damage, to hit doubles, to work the gaps. And so when he gets pitched middle away and he's able to stay back and get his hands going at full speed and hit screamers to left center, what does that tell you is in there? It tells you there's natural timing. It tells you there's bat speed. That's what you need to have power. You need timing and you need bat speed.
No question. Another interesting sort of late round guy that people can overlook sometimes is the injured guy. We see every couple years a guy who their junior, senior year, you know, high school, college, whatever, shortened by an injury, they drop a little bit, but, you know, they get healthy and all of a sudden there's some good things there. Are there any of those guys for you in this list? A guy who was limited by injury this year, but, you know, you can see the scenario in which they get healthy and then, you know, maybe have a chance to outperform some of their rankings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think Nick Storrs from New York City fits that profile a little bit. Not necessarily not a totally injured guy, but had experienced a little bit of a dead arm this spring. Did come back at the end. You know, velocity was never this spring where it had been in the past. You know, so he's kind of a guy you're hoping to take. You give him some rest. You know. Let him get a little bit stronger. I mean, he's huge. He's pretty dang strong right now. This kid's, I mean, it's, I think I wrote in my report on him, it's like a Gronkowski body comp. but so you're going to want to, with him, you're going to want to add a little bit more strength and maybe a little more stability and flexibility and looseness to his delivery. But, you know, he dead arm. This is a guy who was 93, 95 at East Coast Pro less than a year ago, with a pretty good breaking ball and strike throwing ability. So a dead arm, 87, 91 this spring, not what you were looking for. I think that the high school right-hander category, it's always a risky demographic, obviously. It's the riskiest one, really, that in high school catching. But you look at guys like Hunter Ruth. Hunter Ruth, who was trending towards potentially the first round early in the season, ended up needing Tommy John surgery and you know, is out. But he was 97 with a plus slider, and he's committed to Florida. But I do think there's enough interest in him where somebody's going to take him in the third or fourth round and overpay him, and he's going to do his rehab in pro ball. But not that that's any certainty with how the board's going to play. But I think that's a possibility for him. Carlos, were there any injured guys that stick out for you?
Another guy, he's higher up the board than some of the guys we've been talking about. But Joe Perez is another Florida righty who's got a lot of premium stuff, but we actually just reported that he went down with ulnar. He tore his UCL, has to have Tommy John surgery, so he's going to be out for a while. He's committed to Miami, and Perez is interesting in general. I know we've talked about him a little bit more than some of these other guys, so I don't know how long we want to talk about him just to get some other guys in there. But no, he's got really premium stuff, maybe some of the best raw stuff in the class as far as prep pitchers go, but he's only pitched for like 2 years now. Mm-hmm. So scouts are worried about whether he's a starter or a reliever in the future, whether he can kind of get some more consistency with his breaking ball and his off-speed stuff. And he's really hit better than he's pitched this season. He dealt with some shoulder tendonitis, I know, earlier this spring. So he's just an interesting guy in general, but that Tommy John surgery will kind of throw things up in the air a little bit.
I think he's a good example of a player to talk about, like, with this two-way theme of the class. We have so many two-way prospects in this class, college and high school, and it's important to remember how hard that is to do.
I think it's easy to kind of forget about how difficult that is to do.
And it's easy because these guys are making it look easy. Mm-hmm. and that's what's really astonishing about it, whether it's Adam Haseley or Hagan Danner, Brendan McKay, these guys who have been thought of at the top of the class, or these guys who are later on guys, who's the Emerson Hancock down in Cairo, Georgia, South Georgia, near the Panhandle, middle of nowhere, basically, from what I was told. But this guy would play shortstop in game one of the doubleheader and then go pitch game two of the doubleheader. And so,
and Joe's the guy who played third base for his
and
team.
Joe Perez plays third base, and you got to make a lot of throws at third base. Mm-hmm. He's
not easing up over there. We saw him in the NHSI.
No, I mean, he's probably throwing 97 mile an hour bullets to first base through Alex Terrell's glove. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, he can get some carry on that ball at third base, but he's going to be an interesting situation because, yeah, we'll see if a team does still have interest and tries to make a shot, make a run at him in the draft. But if not, it sounds like he's going to be ready to DH at Miami as a freshman, so he's got a chance to play right away. Probably wouldn't pitch in his freshman year if he went, but could come back and be an impactful relief arm. And I think that's ultimately, with a guy like Perez, what you're probably expecting, is a guy who's going to end up in the bullpen and throw gas. He might be upper 90s with a plus slider. You know, that's kind of the dream scenario for him. But, you know, you can't deny what he's done with the bat and the power potential there either.
For sure.
One other guy that, you know, had an injury that I do think is interesting is Cameron Bishop at UC Irvine. This is a guy who's, you know, 6'4", 235-pound left-hander, fastball up to 95. You know, command has been a little shaky, but you talk about big body, power arm. He was drafted out of high school, pitched, you know, decently well for a really good program at UC Irvine. Suffered an oblique injury 2 days before opening day, cost him the season. But there was still a sense, you know, talking to various evaluators around the game, that a left-handed arm that's that explosive, that is collegiate, that is on a good body, that has a performance track record, isn't going to fall too far. So whereas before there was talk, you know, if he had a big season, he could go as high as the second or third round. Now it's obviously much lower, but it's still top 10 rounds consideration for a guy who didn't throw a single collegiate inning this year. So I think he's an interesting guy for me. Now maybe he, you know, as teams get the medicals, there's more they see they don't like. I have heard some teams say they think he's actually going to maybe just medical redshirt and go back to school. There's a Scott Boras consideration there as a Boras client as well. So there's a couple different ways this can play out with him. But I think purely on just the talent, the stuff, the body, there's enough interest there. And, you know, if someone pops him in the seventh round and offers him some big money, you never know. He's just an interesting guy to me.
You know, it sort of reminds me of last year we had Will Crow in a similar kind of situation. And I remember seeing Will Crow as a sophomore, and I go in and watch South Carolina against Kentucky, and this guy's pumping mid-90s, pitching off of this fastball, showing this hard hammer-breaking ball, and he gets injured in the middle toward the end of his sophomore year there. He ends up coming back just in time. You know, he's healthy just in time for the end of his junior season. But he doesn't pitch for South Carolina. He pitches in the Coastal Plains League. He makes a few starts there, so he maintains his medical redshirt. Was asking for big money and comes back, and he's earned it. I mean, he pitched really well early in the season. He was trending towards the first round. He kind of tapered off a little bit towards the end, but that shows you what's in there with some of these injured players. Sure, they're risky. They're gonna be risky. They're hurt. It's not an easy thing. It's no guarantee to come back from an injury. But if they do come back, it's this value pick kind of situation where you might be able to get them with a later pick. You might still have to pay them. You might still have to pay them more money with a later round pick, go over slot, something like that. But you might end up with a really nice player. And, you know, there's a significantly less opportunity cost when you use a 14th round pick on one of these guys. Because if you get it done, great. If you don't get it done, fine. You're going to get all the players you need to fill out your short season league teams in the 20th to 40th round anyways. So I think that's a great point. And it's interesting now, you know, we've seen sort of this explosion of Tommy Johns, unfortunately. And it's interesting how many guys there are who've already had Tommy John and are back from Tommy John. Like, there's probably 5 to 10 guys in our 500 who are Tommy John survivors and are throwing mid-90s again.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got a couple of them on my state list, too. I mean, even beyond just the 500, you see these guys. And, you know, that's one of those things. I think it was last year, Billy Gasparino, the Dodgers scouting director, on a conference call with reporters, when people were asking about, you know, the Tommy John thing, he made a comment like, well, everyone's had Tommy John now. I mean, obviously, he was, you know, exaggerating. But you get the point that for a lot of these teams now, it's become common enough that they almost don't blink, which...
Yeah, I mean, the Braves have made a strategy of targeting Tommy John guys just so they can get guys for some value, so you definitely see it happening.
Mm-hmm. And it is crazy, though, and it bothers me, like, when you know, Evan Steele the other night, who's lefty out of Chipola, and Chipola's the coaching staff has done a great job there. They're going to have maybe a dozen guys drafted this year, but this guy missed time earlier in the year with a blood clot, and... you know, slowly worked back. His stuff was recovering, and he's pitched really well down the stretch. And then he goes and throws 140-something pitches in the JUCO World Series.
Yeah, that was a little... not great.
I mean, there are so many issues I have with that. I mean, that's...
Well, I mean, blood clot's a whole different animal, too. I mean Tommy John's bad, but...
Overuse in general, I think that we can do better. As a game, we can do better. We don't need to force kids to do that for the glory of these moments. But I do think that gonna go in a totally different direction and escape the draft conversation for a second here and talk about Duren Olinger.
Duren Olinger. I was about to ask you about that.
We gotta get Duren in during this conversation.
I watched him on Friday in Chapel Hill. Obviously, Davidson upset the number 2 national seed North Carolina team this weekend, if you didn't know. But Duren's thrown something like 300 pitches the last 2 weeks in his conference tournament and then the regional. He started on Friday and then threw 2 innings.
It seems like he's working up to eventually throw like 400 pitches this coming weekend.
You know, it's an interesting consideration because he's a guy that is going to pharmacy school in the fall. He's not a prospect. So in a lot of ways, this is it for him.
And
this
he's admitted that he's not going.
Right.
He's not a prospect.
So it's sort of that interesting kind of dynamic of what you're willing to do when you know this is the end of your career versus a guy like an Evan Steele who there is a pro future there and how you kind of balance that. And I think it's been an interesting debate.
And it's there's a lot to be said for glory at the level, the amateur level. That matters. That's not nothing. But when you think about a guy whose career is going to be over, you know, you still do risk your personal health, you know. You know, as far as, you know, just talking to some players who have had Tommy John and either been out of college baseball afterwards or have been cut from their teams or transferred, my understanding is that most insurance policies will only cover you until you can lift a gallon of milk. And that's basically their standard for, okay, your arm's healthy now. Mm-hmm. And after that, if you want to do further rehab and then build back real strength to eventually hold your kid up in the air above your head, you know, things like that, you're kind of on your own. So those are risks. Obviously, you're gonna take risks whenever you're out there throwing a ball, even mid 80s. But I think it's not a black and white discussion when we're talking about somebody whose career might be over tomorrow. You know, and just because they're not good enough to play at the next level, rather than somebody whose career is going to be has the potential to last another decade or 15 years.
Really,
but that was the tangent of all tangents.
That was.
I mean, I'm talking about a guy who throws 86, who's not going to get drafted, who's 27 years old or whatever he is, and 22, 23.
You know, moving back toward the draft, we are going to take some questions. We have a couple on the various social media platforms. Hud, why don't you give us some of what we've gotten so far?
I've got one if you want.
Yeah, I'm going to send out a tweet. Draft questions.
Yeah,
please.
I've already got one from John Gilraith on Twitter. We appreciate your question, John. He asks, what's your take on Logan Chapman? I guess I'll just go ahead and defer to you, Hudson.
Yeah, Logan Chapman. I only saw Logan Chapman pitch once. You know, we trust our sources on him. Projectable bodied guy. I believe he's 6'3", 180. You're going to pitch in the upper 80s, low 90s. You know, if you take him, you're projecting him based on the velocity that he's going to have in the future. And also, you got pretty good breaking ball. So, projection guy. And when we talk about projection guys, especially on the high school side, it's really beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. You know, it's somebody might say, look at that guy and say, I love him in the third round. And somebody might say, well, I love these other 10 guys in the third round better. So there's that. It's always very difficult to predict what's going to happen with those, you know, those middle rounds kind of guys. And
to build off of that, that's one of the most interesting things for me. My first year really immersed in the draft process to the level I have been here at Baseball America. Look, everyone knows who the top, you know, 50, 100 guys are. There's no question about it. But really, as soon as you almost hit 150, which is still pretty high in the grand scheme of things, you really start getting some diverging opinions. And especially when it came to the high schoolers, there's guys where it was straight up, he could go in the 10th round to, I have zero interest. I mean, so much of it is that eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
And it's not just for the 20th round guys. We're talking about guys, you know, as high as third and fourth rounders who...
You even see that for Joe Adell with some teams.
And it's amazing. You get on the phone with a scout, they're like, I think, you know, Zach Hogeson's got some real interesting power. I really like this guy. I see good crowds at his game. I think he's going to go pretty good. You pick up the phone, you call somebody else, you're like, oh, I'm not on this guy. And it's like, there's so many diverging opinions. And to... We try to rank these players based on the consensus evaluation of them. Not necessarily consensus on where they're going. Signability makes that impossible. Mm-hmm. But the consensus evaluation, what if we pulled everyone in the industry, what would the opinions be on this player if we kind of amalgamated all that together?
Right. It's important to remember we're reporters reporting what essentially the industry consensus is. This isn't like, oh, this is what I necessarily see.
Yeah.
This is, we're trying to build a consensus for the industry.
Yeah, I mean, and there are some players, you know, in this role, we're going to have 10 conversations about those kinds of players, right?
No question.
Whereas sometimes a scout is going to go see them two or three times, and that's going to be their only information on them. So it's not necessarily that we have more information, it's just different information. It's like we have a scouting department who's helping us rather than an individual who, and just one look, one person's take. So we're sort of trying to put that all together and smush it together and make a nice list out of it.
That's how the sausage gets made.
Yeah. So let's take a couple more.
I got one about the Clemson guys in this range. Clemson obviously has some guys that are going to be well up in the top 200. But what about guys like Chase Pinder and Alex Eubanks with Clemson? Anything on them?
Yeah. Both are just. They're just good, steady baseball players. And Eubanks isn't going to overpower you. You know, going to be upper 80s, low 90s. He's gotten the job done in, you know, the place where you need to get the job done.
And everyone always needs arms.
You need arms. You need guys who compete. So, I mean, and Pinder, you have a guy who's playing center field right now. Got some bloodlines. Older brother having success at the big league level, obviously. You know, so... The other one on that team, I mean, Charlie Barnes. Charlie Barnes is, you want to talk about competitor. This guy's statistically has performed all year. He's gotten some pretty good hitters out. When he's working right, he's got above average fastball movement, plus changeup. Going to be upper 80s right now. But you're kind of hoping with him you get a little more velocity down the road. He's shown low 90s in the past. You know, maybe he goes to the bullpen and becomes just a nasty reliever. He doesn't necessarily have like an out pitch against lefties, interestingly enough, because his breaking ball is kind of like a spinner. It kind of, you know, it's more of a change of pace breaking ball. Mm-hmm. And then that change up is just death on you know, right-handed hitters. I mean, the Clemson team, I saw Jeremy Beasley 92-95 the other night. They've got Paul Campbell who could go later. You know, obviously they have Seth Beer for next year. We're not going to talk about Seth Beer today. We're going to have a lot of conversations about Seth Beer.
That's next year's podcast.
Yeah, basically, yeah, we're going to have the Seth Beer hour where we're all going to debate Seth Beer for an hour next year. Look forward to that 2018 draft coverage. So a couple more here, and then we'll look to wrap it up. Anything stick out to you, Carlos? Just look at my Twitter here.
Let's see.
This is riveting radio here, huh? Us looking at questions.
Yeah.
Hud just has so many options. It's amazing. He asks for a couple questions, and then boom, there's 30 responses right away. The people love you, Hud. That's what it is.
I don't know about that, but at least I got him fooled into thinking that I have some answers. So
people really just want you to tell them who their favorite team is going to be drafting number one.
Exactly, and we'll have mock drafts coming. So I see, where do you see Jeter Downs going? Jeter Downs is an interesting one. This is a high school shortstop. Name does come from Derek Jeter. I'm not sure exactly what the origin story of that is. Mike Linando reported on that a little bit at the Area Code Games last year. But he is... he's proven himself to be one of the better bats in the high school class, for many evaluators at least, and he's got a chance to play shortstop. So he's probably going to go in the top 50 picks. I mean, that description goes in the top 50 picks. I think probably somewhere 30 to 40, 45, something like that is what I've heard mostly on where he'll land. Forget where exactly we have him.
I know we have scouts split on whether or not he'll stick at shortstop, but I guess for you personally, do you think he's going to
he got the tools to stick? He's got elements. He definitely has the tools to stick there. With these young guys, it's really difficult to get a feel for them in the springtime. Like, what Jeter Downs has shown, he's shown flashes of above average to plus hands. Mm-hmm. He's shown fringy to average range at shortstop. And he's shown like 55 arm strength. Mm-hmm. That's his best throws. He's going to give you a 55 arm, right? So, you know, as he matures and becomes a little more consistent, improves his footwork, positions himself better, does this guy have a chance to play shortstop? Yeah, I think he does. The real question, I think, on whether you can play shortstop now in the big leagues might be whether you can hit.
Isn't that crazy?
Like, if you can hit, you can play shortstop. Like, what?
Really, both middle infield positions. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about, and that, trying not to go too far off a tangent here, is with the increase in shifting and defensive kind of advanced scouting and how that way it's gone now, there's almost less emphasis than ever before on range because, like, don't worry about it. We'll position you where you need to be so you can make the plays you have to. And it's kind of an interesting dynamic, and we're seeing a lot more bulkier, stockier, you know, hit-first guys playing the middle infield that you never used to see in the 70s and 80s. And some of that is, with all the new defensive metrics and advanced scouting that goes into it, they just position them a little bit better. And so that step or two short they used to be, they're positioned well enough to make up for it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think we hear that on Jeter Downs a little bit, and we hear it on Tyler Freeman a little bit, the SoCal shortstop at Awanda High School, who's really a bat first prospect. That's really his main appeal is that if you like him, he can really hit. Defensively, you think maybe we can hide him at shortstop for a little while and he'll move over to second ultimately.
But generally speaking, utility defensive infielder is sort of what I've consistently gotten on him. But you talk about makeup and instincts, the little things that can make everything play up a little bit, and you know, just led Etiwanda to a championship at Dodger Stadium, made really nice defensive plays there, made, you know, a couple nice plays at the plate as well throughout their playoff run. You know, another guy that you just talk about, when you have good makeup, you have instincts, you know how to position yourself well, that a lot of times will carry you further than some of the super toolsy guys who at a certain point, you have to be able to understand the mental side of the game and what's happening and how to adjust to it. So it's just kind of an interesting dynamic with a guy like him.
Yeah.
And seeing, cause sometimes those guys adjust. I mean,
and the thing about that kind of stuff is, like, you know, for so long you hear answers like that, or plays the game the right way, you know, good teammate, all that. And it sounds cliche, and it doesn't sound like it's really impactful. But when you really internalize that and think about what it means to a player on a day-to-day basis, like, this is a conversation I had with J.J. Matijevic when I did that story on him. It's his focus is completely on the team and what the team needs to do, what his teammates need from him as a leader, rather than focusing on his last at-bat and the pitch that he should have swung at but didn't. So it totally changes the frame of reference in your mind when you are a good teammate. You're focused on doing the little things right rather than, you know, shifting your focus to with the things that you did wrong, maybe pressing, putting a little too much pressure on yourself, trying to do too much. I'm using all the cliches here.
Just got to get out there and execute.
Yeah, exactly. Best shape of their lives. take it day by day. We'll see. Not sure who we're going to pitch tomorrow, but yeah, I mean, we'll take a look at the
really
lineup
tonight. Really came together.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, all the classics.
All of this stuff. I think maybe we'll do one more, and then we'll wrap it. I guess. Right. Did anything stick out to you from the questions, Carlos?
No, not the questions. There is one guy I kind of want to talk about, though, in North Carolina catcher. I know we've talked about risk and demographics that are risky in the draft, and I feel like a high school catcher is one of the most risky.
It is the single riskiest part of the project I'm doing. It is, I mean, high school right-handers, like, at least there's a couple of them mm-hmm. who make it. High school catchers, it's really, really bad.
Yeah, so a guy like Patrick Bailey is a catcher who really sticks out to me. I think he could be maybe the best defensive catcher in the class, at least from a prep standpoint. He's a North Carolina State commit. And we saw him, I believe me and Hudson actually saw him when we went to see Austin Beck.
Yeah,
obviously
matched up against Austin.
Exactly. Yeah. And the way he sequenced Austin Beck in one of his plate appearances was extremely impressive to me. He's really athletic back there, very balanced, receives the ball really well. And I'm pretty sure he was more responsible than the pitcher for striking Beck out, just with the way he sequenced him working with his pitcher.
Yeah, and I've reported on him a little bit. I wrote a story on him for the magazine. I'm not sure if it ran online or not, but that's the really impressive thing about Patrick Bailey and a few catchers like this. Mm-hmm. They call their own games.
Yep.
And that skill and the analytical approach to the game and being able to read swings and also being able to understand analysis of other hitters, opposing hitters, and your pitcher's strengths and weaknesses, and being able to go out there and calm them down and say, hey, man, your breaking ball's not there. Your fastball's dancing. Let's go throw it. You know, giving your pitchers some confidence like that. And you talk to some of the Team USA pitchers that he was able to catch last summer, and they all love throwing to him, and it's for exactly reasons like that. And so I think he's a little bit of an interesting case because he's almost like a college catcher in a lot of ways, at least in terms of how he's developed, how refined he is defensively, which is interesting because college catchers right now, like you go to the Abbey League or the Pioneer League, you're going to look at your college catcher behind the plate. He's going to be looking over the dugout for signs.
Yeah.
And he's going to go look in the dugout, and the coach is going to be like, what do you want? Go call the pitch, man. Figure it out. Whereas you have some high school guys who have earned trust back behind the plate from their high school coaches and call their own pitches. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're going to have to mature as adults and hitters and all that. But they're in some ways, they're more ready to roll back there. But on the demographic point of that, we have the high school right-handers, they're risky, sure, but, and this is a story I also wrote that went in the magazine a few months back, beginning of the season, is they're risky to take at the very top of the draft.
There's a lot of supplemental first-rounders who have done really well. Noah Syndergaard, Aaron Sanchez, a lot of those guys taken 30 to 40, some of them actually have a better track record than the guys taken 1 to 10 by high school right-handers.
And that's because, and talking to scouts for that story, that's because high school right-handed pitchers, or high school pitchers in general, have such a wide range of possibilities, and they can change so quickly. It can be, all right, oh, you've only been throwing a two-seamer? All right, let's give you a four-seam. Now there's more velocity. Or nobody taught you how to use your hips a certain way? Okay, let's see what we do if we change this one thing. You need to add 20 pounds? Let's get you in the weight room and get you some chicken this week, this winter, and see how that goes. So there's so many things that can happen with a high school right-hander pitcher that they're really valuable in the second to fifth round, right? Because you can get a handful of good ones. You can get good athletes with projectable bodies, projectable stuff, and then you don't have to use your first-round pick on that kind of guy. You can get somebody who can develop and be that kind of first-round type talent in a year or 2 years, and you can get them in the third round. The high school catching is a little bit different than that because you look around the big leagues. Who are the high school catchers?
So that, well, that's funny.
Devin Mesoraco.
He's not
Tucker
right now.
Barnhart.
It's Tucker Barnhart. It's Austin Hedges. The two first round high school catchers of the 40 most used catchers in the big leagues right now, two were high school first rounders. They are Jeff Mathis and Travis d'Arnaud. You look, no exceptions. who are the best catchers in baseball, it is college guys and guys from outside the continental U.S. And I say it that way because the Puerto Rico guys were technically drafted. Yadier Molina, Martin Maldonado. So they're technically drafted, but high school continental U.S. catchers, it's at a point where you actually look at what do catchers look like in the big leagues where you say, just don't do it. Just and even some of the ones who worked out, JT Realmuto, he wasn't a catcher in high school. Mm-hmm. Tony Walters wasn't a catcher in high school. Mm-hmm. I mean, the number of guys who actually played catcher in high school, the 40 most used catchers in the big leagues, seven of them were high schoolers, and most of them, I mean, Austin Hedges is the best, but even he was drafted in 2011. He came up in 2015, but that was more of an injury issue. He's not really a big league catcher until 2017. So if you're a franchise, unless you can wait 6-7 years, mm-hmm. just don't do it.
I feel like we know who Austin Hedges is really well. Like, you have Southern California roots. Obviously, you're going to know who Austin Hedges is. He was the man out there for a while. Like, prospect people know who he is because he's been one of the most pumped up catching prospects in the minors for a long time. But when you think of, all right, who are the household names who are catchers?
No,
Austin Hedges isn't on that list. Right. And when you think of a first-round pick, don't you want a household name?
And exactly, and that's where I go back to the first-round high school, continental U.S. high school catchers in the big leagues. It's Travis Darno and Jeff Mathis. Not only not household names, those are second-division guys. It's not even like, oh, they're actually pretty good, but they're underappreciated. It's one's a backup, and the other can't stay healthy and is on his team in fourth place.
And that's the thing. I look at that demographic, and like you said, the ones who go high, there isn't a good track record of them because there's so many things that have to change, right? You have to go from catching some mid-80s guys every, like maybe your hardest throwing guy is mid-80s in high school, right? And then you go to pro ball, and the softest throwing guy is throwing 93, and he's got a hammer breaking ball that he has no idea how to throw for strikes. So you got to run around for 9 innings trying to catch guys like that, and then guess what? You got to go do it tomorrow, and the day after that, and the day after that, and the day after that, and you got to do it for 6 months, and oh, by the way, we want you to hit too, and hit for some power. So it's hard to do. It's a really hard thing to do.
And it's the better place to learn to do it most effectively is in college, and we see that again. Just the proof is in the pudding. You look at who the guys, the big leaguers are. By and large, you know, aside from the international guys, the guys who are drafted, continental U.S., it's the college guys.
But I do want to address your point about continental U.S. because I think
Puerto Rico is a good run.
There's a couple guys to talk about in Puerto Rico this year who are like, and that's sort of my thinking on it. Is like, if I'm picking in the second round and I have a chance to go get a really projectable high school right-hander, and I got a good college bat in the first round. And I've got, so, and so I take my projectable high school right-hander instead of a high school catcher in the second round, right? I can get to the, whether it's the 6th round or the 11th round or the 12th round, I can usually go down to Puerto Rico and find a guy who can really catch and throw, who
Yachty doesn't, the fourth doesn't, rounder.
I mean, and there's a guy, Santi Sanchez, who's in our rankings, late 200s, early 300s, forget exactly where he is.
We got him at 368.
So Santi Sanchez, I have guys who say, well, he's got a 70 arm. He's getting, most would put 60 on it. But this guy's got a cannon arm. He's kind of like a thicker-bodied guy, like a Hudson Belinsky body comp. So he's a bigger guy. He's going to have to work on his conditioning. But he's pretty fluid and athletic back there. He can really catch the ball. So I can go get that guy a little bit later. And I don't have to use a high pick on a guy who ultimately probably is going to be a backup. I mean, if we're just talking
best
about
case scenario,
historic
high school continent,
and you never want to use that and use it against an individual. If there's a catcher who showed up with 70 tools across the board, yeah, I don't care about the demographics if there's 70 tools across the board and he's got great track record and all that. You wouldn't use demographics against him in that case. But most of the time, broad strokes thinking, you're going to want to look at the history of that and see who's done it. And the reality is that most of them haven't made it or haven't lived up to the expectations that a first-round pick carries.
No question about it. On that note, I think it should about wrap it up. We've got a lot more draft coverage coming up here. We've got state lists about to hit the web later on this week. And then next week, boys, Monday, first round. It's already here.
Yeah, I mean, we're really close. And I think... you know,
Hudson's going to sleep for 3 weeks straight after this, by the way, folks. So if you don't hear from him for a while after the draft,
going straight down to Florida, start up the next year's cycle.
Yeah, it's an exciting time, and I think that I would be remiss if I didn't give you guys a thanks here and on the podcast. I think that you guys have done fantastic work. I would also add in John Manuel and JJ Cooper. Their reporting on the draft has been extensive and thorough and greatly appreciated. It was a team effort when we got here, and the 500's done.
Yep. Well, be sure to go check
baseball
that out.
America isn't basic. We're not stopping at 500. We're gonna have another probably 500 or 600 players ranked on our state list.
Right now we're close to 1,000 with the state list players we have added, and that should be over 1,000 by the end of the day today. So.
Yeah, and we're not gonna give you 200 words on the 197th best prospect in Florida, but we're gonna give you a couple lines. You should be able to know generally who these guys are. So there's plenty of content coming. It's a fantastic time to subscribe to Baseball America. You can go to baseballamerica.com/store, get access to all our top 500 reports, all our bonus reports on every single player, potentially. Not necessarily every player, but my goal at Baseball America is to know who everyone drafted is, and so that you, our readers, can know who everyone drafted is and know who they are and why they got drafted. So we're not perfect, but we're trying to get an inch closer to perfect every day, and I think it's a great time to subscribe to BA.
It's a game of inches, speaking of cliches. Yeah. Here we go.
Of course.
All right, well, that'll do it. Folks, for Carlos Collazo and Hudson Blinsky, I'm Kyle Glazer. Thank you for tuning in today. Today's podcast was sponsored by Baseballism. Visit baseballism.com for the best apparel in baseball. Enter the code BA2017 to receive free shipping on your next order. Thanks for tuning in, folks. We'll see you soon.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.